admonition. The notions and sentiments declared by the gadabouts in this audio program are not endorsed by the Japanese Animation Information Network. I do hope the show meets your fancy.
Welcome to ANCAST. I'm Zach Birchie. Justin's here as well. And my guest today is a guy with a long history in the field of manga and anime translation. Sort of a legend, I would say. His latest project is Bride Story, which is from Yen Press. William Flanagan. Hey, William, or Bill, as you sometimes are called.
Yep, I'm called Bill an awful lot. Hi, Zach. How's it going? Hi, Justin.
Howdy.
Thanks for coming on the show. So, right up front, you've got a long history, so can we start from the beginning? How did you get started in manga translation, and when?
Well, started doing manga translation in my second... before that, I was an anime fan. I was an anime fan from about 82, 83, and before that, I was a long-time fan of animation in itself. In the late 70s, I saw Star Blazers, so... but didn't know it was Japanese. But in the early 80s, I was sophisticated enough to know it was Japanese and started following it then. So around 84, 85, I've got bad knees, and I knew I couldn't work standing up all the time. So I was thinking about what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And I wanted to sit down and do something I could do sitting down. And I decided, well, you know, I love this anime and manga, so why don't I give translation of that a try? So I took classes and stuff like that. Took a year in Japan on a student exchange. And finally, around 90, I hooked up with a couple of friends, Jay Parks and Pam Ferdy. Jay's a computer programmer, and Pam's another translator like myself. And we sort of formed a company. And we got, in 91, we got a contract to do The Humanoid for CPM.
Always a classic. And,
yes, always. No one will ever forget The Humanoid, will they?
And, oh, come on.
And almost exactly the same time, I got a contract to do a series called Raika for a fly-by-night manga publisher called Sun Comics. And that went out. It was came out like four times a month, and went for about a year. And then the comic company flew by night. But so they both happened about 1991. So that's when I actually got started professionally working in as a translator in anime and comics.
And where were you based at this point?
In Tucson. Actually, I heard, Zach, that you have some connection with Tucson Animation Screening Society.
I was president of it in the late 90s.
Really?
Yeah, I grew up in Tucson, went to college at U of A. And I,
cool.
Yeah. Oh, TAS.
Yeah, I named it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, before that, Patty Duffield had started it as CFO Tucson. And at one point, CFO decided to charge everybody fees based on how many people were in the club. And TAS had something like 50 people, and there was no way we would get fees from everybody. So we decided to cut CFO off and just be our own club. And a bunch of people came up with names for what the new club should be named. My suggestion was Tucson Animation Screening Society, and that was the one that got voted in.
Yeah, interestingly enough, in my time there, they brought the fees back.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they wanted like $20 a year, which is ridiculous for college kids.
That'll cut down your membership really quick. When we were started, it was a really big, wide membership in the thing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in its heyday, you know, like I'm talking like 97, 98, at least what could be considered its heyday then, we packed a room about 500 people to watch a really shitty bootleg. Really shitty bootleg of Princess Mononoke, like right when the Laserdisc came out. Yeah, those were the days. But so you did a lot of work for CPM, as Justin can attest to, right?
Right, right. We our first client was for anime was CPM. This was in the Studio Nemo, which was our which was the company I formed with Jay Parks and Pam Ferdy. And we did a bunch of stuff for CPM. We did things like the Rumic World series, Heroic Legend of Arslan. We did some subtitling-only projects like the Grave of the Fireflies and I think Galforce, our involvement was just in subtitles. But yeah, we did a whole lot of stuff for CPM. We also did a bunch of stuff for Manga Entertainment UK. Sometimes it was the same stuff that we did for CPM, but we made sure that the translations were different for both.
You just did a find replace so you could charge double?
Boy, I wish. No, wow. we were ethical about it. We actually started back from scratch, and there was about 7-8 months in between when we did the first and the second. And when we finally finished it and sent it off and then compared them, we were surprised at how different the two translations actually turned out to be.
Well, so
one of the advantages, though, of doing the same thing is you don't have to look up the same words twice all that much.
Right? Yeah. So what, I mean, that's probably kind of an alien concept now. Why did they want a different subtitle track?
Well, actually, it wasn't a different subtitle. Manga Entertainment was mainly doing dubs.
Okay.
And for a lot of the things that CPM and Manga Entertainment were putting out, the same titles at the same time, Manga Entertainment would buy our subtitles from CPM and then do their dub tracks from our subtitles. But for some reason, for a couple of them, they didn't get the subtitles tracks from CPM, so they just hired us to do it again.
That's weird.
Yeah, it was. I don't know why it happened, but, you know, hey, it's money.
Do you remember what the major differences were and why there were major differences?
Nah, this was like 94.
Okay.
I can't really. Generally, the differences were pretty much all would pretty much all have been in phraseology.
Right.
The meaning would be the same. The phrasing would be just a little different. And that's all based on, you know, however you felt at the time when you were doing the translation.
That had to be really difficult working with a client in the UK in those days, didn't it? Or wasn't it?
Not so bad. We were still, I think most of the communication was still through email, so it wasn't so much of a time difference problem. And we got paid on time, which was, you know, good stuff for everybody. So I don't really see all that, didn't see all that much of a problem. Nothing any more difficult than doing anybody else's translations would be.
Oh, so there's no, like, PAL time code garbage and stuff.
Oh, no,
like
no. Actually, they just send us, you're right there. There was no PAL time code garbage on that, which means that they probably had some sort of, way they could dub directly to an NTSC VHS tape.
Oh, weird.
Either that or, you know, like I said, most of them were base scripts for their ADR stuff for doing dubs. So,
and those got rewritten to hell anyway.
Right. And they didn't even credit us on most of them because they did get rewritten to hell. And, you know, I don't mind as long as we get paid. So basically, you know, if we already had the in a few cases, we already had the Japanese tape or Laserdisc or something like that on hand. And since we didn't need time codes for just doing a base translation script, we just, did it from whatever we had and sent it off to them.
Now, I know you mentioned, this was 94 and a lot of the details are hazy, but from your anime projects back then in the 90s, do you remember one that was particularly challenging or really gave you a lot of headaches?
Well, there's the one that I blogged about on my ancient blog back in 2006. It was a Manga UK release called Ankoku Shinwa, which is The Dark Myth. And,
oh, God.
Yeah, that was a fun one. And basically, it was one of those shows where the writer wants to pull in stuff from all sorts of different areas. And one of them was the Gishiwa Jinden, which is the section of the Romance of the Three Kingdoms that describes how a few people from the land of Gi came to the land of Wa, which is apparently ancient Japan, and, you know, discussed the queen there, the country of Yamatai, and the queen Himiko. And all of these are now considered ancient history of Japan pre any sort of Japanese writing. So that was pulled from 4th century AD, actually had some Japanese history, so they pulled from that. They pulled from some of the tantric Buddhist writings, and one of the things they pulled from was tantric astrology. And tantric astrology is the 28 signs that go around the ecliptic. And one of the plot points was that one of the stars in one of the signs was incredibly important to the plot, and I don't remember exactly how it was, but they were always talking about it, how it was in Orion's belt. And for the translation, we went out looking for the actual tantric astrology names of these stars, but the most important one we couldn't find. And so I spent probably 4 or 5 days in the University of Arizona library looking through every tantric astrology book they had, and they had a surprising amount of them, probably more than a dozen. And finally found it and found out that the writer had gotten it wrong. The star wasn't in Orion's belt. It was somewhere around Orion's shoulder. And that was what was throwing me off for all of those days before that. So that one was the real struggle. I call it translate. There are several translation from hells that I come up with, and that was the research quagmire translation from hell, because you just have to go out and research everything that you can to get the translation right.
And I'm sure in that era you couldn't really ask the licensor for help.
No, you can't, and in most cases you can't.
Even now.
The general way it goes is the translator is freelance. He contacts his editor, says, I'd like some information. The editor has to contact their licensing department. Their licensing department has to contact the Japanese licensing department. The Japanese licensing department contacts the, if it's a manga, the mangaka's editor. The mangaka's editor then contacts the mangaka. Assuming it gets that far, anywhere along the line, anybody can say no.
And usually does.
And even if everything goes through, the information has to go back exactly the same way that it went there. So generally the only times you want to give that a try is when it's life and death. When, you have to ask the mangaka or the entire translation will be wrong. So, and I've managed to go through that about maybe 4 or 5 times total. But for the most part, you just don't want to get into that.
Yeah. So glancing over the gigantic list of credits that you have in our encyclopedia, I mean, it's nuts. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that you've worked on every single manga ever published.
No, it is an exaggeration to say that. I wish I had. But I've worked on quite a few. The manga stuff was mainly after about 2008. Before 2008, it was sort of spotty. And prior to 1998. Prior to 1998, it was spotty. Prior to that, it was mostly anime.
Right. So when did you, is this just sort of like a natural transition? Was it a workflow thing where that was where the work was?
Well, it was, I got hired by Viz.
Okay.
that does it.
Yeah. And it didn't exactly stop there. Once I got hired by Viz, I was mainly working on manga because I was hired on as the editor for Animerica Extra magazine, which had, 5 or 6 or 7 manga running in the magazine at any particular month.
But because
I was on that, I was also the one most closely associated with Video Girl Eye. So even after I got into Viz. I was also helping like production coordination or something like that for Video Girl Eye and a couple of other anime until I completely ramped up and went over to the manga side. Also, there's a bunch of things in the encyclopedia which have me as the editor-in-chief or like executive editor or overseeing editor or something to that effect. And with that, your actual participation in the manga is pretty minimal. In a lot of cases, I read it over after the editor reads it over. Or in other cases, I basically, for where it says editor-in-chief, a lot of times I basically helped a little with the licensing process, handed it to the in-house editor and said, go to it. And that's pretty much all my involvement in the creation of that manga was.
So it's sort of final pass. Were you doing like hiring certain freelancers and stuff?
In a lot of cases, yeah. In a lot of cases, there were freelancers where I would, I would want particular freelancers to work on particular items. For example, for the Utena manga, Lillian Olson was just doing base translations at the time, and she was an ace at going through all of the manga, looking for all the symbolism, making sure that she had all of that pat down. And then I'm trying to remember the name of the rewriter for that, but he was basically our ace for doing, slightly occultish style rewrites on there. So those were two people that I definitely wanted to work with. His name will probably pop up somewhere later in the conversation into my mind. I'm not connecting with it now. Damn. Anyway. But yeah, that kind of thing where you know who you want working on the manga when you get it. In a lot of other cases, it's just going up to my managing editor, who was Annette Roman at the time, and saying, okay, well, we've got this new manga in. Who's a good editor for it? Who's free for doing the translation and rewrite, stuff like that.
Now, did you get to choose, because you're listed as editor-in-chief, executive editor on a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Did you, is it sort of like how print magazines work, or, websites are kind of supposed to work now, or you worked your way past the day-to-day grunt work of doing the actual translation and eventually just moved into management? Or did you get to choose projects where you would get to do the grunt work?
I didn't choose as many as I would have liked to have chosen. What happened basically with Viz was we had I started out as assistant editor, moved up to editor pretty quickly because I was in charge of one of the magazines. But then there was this period where we didn't have enough communication going on in the department itself. So, and I could see it. People were, doing the same tasks twice. Two people were, doing the same stuff. And it was mainly because nobody was really talking to each other. So I started getting everybody together for a once a month meeting just to have everybody say, okay, here we are. This is what we're doing, and get everybody talking to each other. And that sort of got me promoted, because I was already doing senior manager, senior editor stuff as a regular editor, and getting to editor in chief was pretty much the same thing. Also, I would take on a few administrative responsibilities and do them for about half a year or sometimes more or less, and then finally get recognized. Yeah, he's actually doing the job, so we'll give him the title. So that's basically how I got to editor-in-chief. But even as editor-in-chief, I was still, for example, doing editing and rewrite on the Zoids manga. I was still editing up till about, only a few months before I left Viz. I was still doing the Animerica Extra editing. So it was. So at the time, my job was a third licensing, a third administrative, and half editing. I know that goes over 100%, but I had a lot of long days there.
Right. So over the course of those years, and I guess we can confine this just to Viz for now anyway, how did the art of translation change for you, or how did you see it changing?
Well, one big quick change was when I was doing Fushigi Yugi. Before that, I was very much in the mode where if it's not translated into English, you haven't done your job. So, so basically, it was the idea that there are a lot of people in fandom even now who think that adding honorifics and stuff like that is extraneous information and they don't want to know it. And if they wanted to learn Japanese, then they wouldn't have bought a translation, that sort of thing, including a little bit of Japanese in the thing. Before I started working at Viz, I was very much against that. If it can be translated, it should be translated. While I was at Viz, I was doing Fushigi Yugi, which has a character by the name of Chichiri, who ends all of his sentences with the sentence-ending particles "noda."
Mm-hmm. Oh, all I remember.
All it is like adding an exclamation, a verbal exclamation point onto the end of your sentence. But the fandom, who had been, I guess, reading scans at the time, loved Noda. They loved it at the end of his sentences. And I was working on Animerica Extra, writing the letters columns, and we got in one letter saying, well, are you going to include the Nodas? Because he wasn't introduced immediately. He was introduced a few volumes down the line. And so I did one thing that you should never do in a letter column, and that is ask a question you don't want to know the answer to. And I asked, I don't know what I'm going to do about the Nodas yet. What do you think? And that was all it is. And then the fans sort of took that as being, Animerica Extra is holding a poll to find out and letting the fans decide whether Nodas stay in or not.
Wonder what the answer was.
Well, the fact is, anybody who really cares about the whether Noda is in or not are the people who will send out emails saying, I want Noda in.
Yeah.
I mean, people who don't care whether it's in or not won't bother, and people who don't know about it to begin with won't bother. So, of course, I got deluged hundreds of emails every single day somehow it got onto the internet, and people started mistaking it, thinking I was in charge of the anime or something like that. You got letters saying, if yous don't stick Noda in our animes, then, I never read you again, or something like that.
In all caps.
You could tell that it was just, they found it on some website. They had no idea who they were sending it into, and they just sent it in as part of, because the person on the website said send it in. But then there was one letter that came in that said, if you this is going to sound really naive and corny, but it said, if you leave in the Nodas, it will make me really happy. And I didn't have an argument against that. The thing is, we're selling stuff to make the audience happy, and these are the people who are going to be buying, Volume 1 through Volume 18. They're not most of the people who just try it will drop out somewhere along the line, but the hardcore ones are the ones who are going to be buying the last volume and making it profitable. So suddenly I got a different, had to look at it from a different perspective, saying, if the fans really want this little piece of Japanese in there, and it doesn't really affect the story, and it's not all that awful, then, what the hell? Why not put it in there? And that's sort of when my whole thinking changed on that. So afterwards, for example, when I started at Del Rey, then leaving in honorifics was basically editorial policy, and I had absolutely no problem with that by that time. So basically, that was one big change, getting back to the question so long ago, that I saw in the thing, is that it changed from being philosophical about translation to practical about translation, knowing your audience and knowing what your audience wants.
Right.
The philosophy of translating everything is, you know, you're trying to make this accessible to everyone that speaks English, not just
exactly.
The nerds.
Exactly. And in this case, everybody who speaks English will probably, you know, the people who don't really care even a little bit about, you know, about knowing a bit of Japanese will probably also not make the effort to read it backwards, read a book backwards. So,
right, there's that.
So you're already aiming at a segment anyway. So as far as I'm concerned at this moment, there's really no downside to adding in a little bit of Japanese that people can either, you know, already know or easily look up.
Now, did that prove to be kind of a sticking point when a character has a very particular way of speaking or has a little catchphrase like that on the end of something that they say? Because I know it says you worked on Kenshin, and he's got a very particular way of talking.
Right, and when I first worked on it, again, I was supervising editor on Kenshin. I sort of handed off the editorial to someone else I knew and trusted. I forget the name, but for Kenshin, I did have a say in how the English came out, because there were certain set phrases and. At the very least, I wanted an equally archaic-sounding set phrase in English that would represent what he was saying in Japanese, rather than, you know, just giving the Japanese basically putting in a phrase that would represent that. And I think it was successful. Kenshin was the most popular. Kenshin 1 was the most popular manga for its year. So I think the decisions that were made on that were pretty good. I don't remember exactly what they are at the moment, but I think they worked for what they were trying to do. We also put in notes at the end of Kenshin. So notes are also a really good thing for when you're a translator. It's a sort of backstop for when you have to make a decision or, God forbid, rewrite a joke that's funny. If you're really writing a joke that's corny, it's okay. But if you're really trying to rewrite a joke that was really funny in the original, then and you're not as funny in the translation, then you've got to have something in the back to say, okay, this was the original joke, and I'm sorry, I'm not that good a comedian.
Well, but that choice on Kenshin wasn't fan driven. It wasn't you getting a deluge of people telling you how you should be doing it.
Right, but it was fan driven in the fact that we were very aware of what the fans were talking about. I'd never actually read any scans on Kenshin or watched any fan dubs, but we were aware of what was coming out in like the forums and such. So we had some input from there. Are you saying that I don't remember seeing any real controversy over the Kenshin manga translation? Was there? Do you remember some?
No, I'm just sort of trying to differentiate between like the editorial choices that are fan friendly that are not demanded by the fans versus editorial decisions that are fan friendly that you're making on your own because you know the fans want it that way, and it must be a tough call. That's all.
Yeah. Yeah, in this case, it was editorial choices that we feel the fans would be comfortable with, and you know, as best as possible, convey the what was being said in the Japanese.
So, when did your time at Viz come to a close?
Well, around 2000. Well, I was the editor in chief between 2002 and 2004 when Tokyopop. Basically changed the way everything worked. And for the first three months or so of Tokyopop putting out the 100% authentic manga, we sort of, you know, laughed at it, because before that, Tokyopop had made major changes to their line about once every 12 to 18 months. And it never actually, you know, impacted their sales too much or did much to it. So we looked at this and said, oh, it's a cost-cutting measure, and it's and it'll probably bite them in the ass or something like that. And
they were also ramping up production an insane amount of the time. They were doing like 20 to 30 SKUs a month.
Yeah, and so right around the summer, or early summer of 2002 is when they put it out. Around August, we could see how well it was doing. And then suddenly it had to be a scramble. We had to dump first thing that had to happen is our licensing department had to go out to each and every one of our licensors and say, okay, this is how manga is changing. We have to rewrite our contracts to make sure that we can we can make the manga that the people want to buy. And that took an awful lot of time. Most people think that Viz was kind of slow to react, but the slowness was between about June and about August. And then afterwards, we reacted as quickly as possible, but quickly as possible for a person taken for a company taken by surprise by the way the market changed so darn quickly. So by about March of the next year, we managed to phase out our monthly comic line, convert a lot of it to tankobon, and then one tankobon every 3 months or so was the goal. So, and before that, with the monthly pamphlet comics, you would be able to compile a tankobon in about 6 months. Now it was once every 3 months, so we were effectively completely doubling our output. And that's not even to mention Shonen Jump, which came in at about the same time, ramping up our number of manga, probably by about another third or so. So I had to go at least double our production without really getting more people. So the entire editorial department throughout basically a year and a half was working overtime nearly every single day and didn't have, and you had your effective breaks, but people weren't taking them. And by the end of that, by the end of about a year and a half of that, I was completely burned out. I was, coming in every day and almost dreading it. And think of this: this is you read comics for a living. I mean, how can you go into the office and actually dread it? But it was getting to that point, and I was made a tentative offer by somebody else to do about the same job for a lot more money. And I looked at this and thought, the money isn't worth it. And if the money isn't worth it there, then the money can't be worth it here. And also at the time, freelancer rates were really good. Mm. I mean, you could make a decent middle class living just doing freelance translation. And so I decided, it's best for me and, for physically to just go ahead and quit Viz and start doing freelance translation instead. So I went back and basically decompressed for the next year and a half. And that was a good decision. At the time, it was a really good decision.
Yeah.
Come the recession, it was a terrible decision because freelancer rates have since plummeted.
Well, at the same time, Viz has hacked out most of their staff.
That's
at
true.
This point,
even
so you
if,
may
I,
not
even
be
if I had
there.
Stayed, I probably would have been hacked.
Well, that's another quick question about that. That time that you're talking about when Tokyo Pop said, hey, we're going to change the entire game. And
yep.
Viz basically sounds like played catch up.
They had to, yeah.
Was that around the same time? Because there's a lot of stories that circulate about Viz's corporate culture changing almost completely during those years.
Not quite. It didn't change on a dime. But the addition of Shueisha, before it was always Shogakukan. Mm-hmm. And with Shogakukan at the time, it may be different now, but at the time, Shogakukan was kind of like the old grandfather who, is real happy to see you when he sees you, but if you walk away for a while, he might forget your name. they were great for – Shogakukan was great for the early 90s because they allowed Viz to have a lot of freedom, make a lot of experiments. But when Shueisha came in, that was the dad with a belt. Mm. So
the best analogy I've heard for Shueisha.
So basically you've got these people, and for very good reason, they invested an awful lot of money into it. And but they wanted it run tight. And so when they came in, there were a bunch of times where I had to do my best to stand up for my editorial department and make sure that nobody was cut out of it, because we were all, you know, working at more than full capacity already. So, so things did become tighter. The culture inside Viz didn't change all that much, aside from the fact that everybody was burned out. But generally, Viz was a place, just before that, Viz was a place where nobody quit. Nobody quit on their own. Everybody loved being there. And after the burnout period, a few people quit, but still there are people who are working there and happily working there now, who were there before I started and would never think of quitting. Because I guess a lot of that culture stayed around. But the culture from the top also has an effect on it. Okay. And they were pretty strict.
So then I guess maybe you can put a rest to this, because the long-standing narrative about those years at Viz was that when Shueisha came in, they basically went through and got rid of the staff who were super fans. They got rid of the, and that's how Anne America got shut down, and that's sort of the story, and I guess maybe that's not true.
It's not true. Actually, probably the years from 2002 to 2004 did more for it than Shueisha coming in doing it.
Okay. Just running them ragged, really. Yeah.
Basically. And even as a super fan, you sort of get strung out and to a point where you don't care quite as much. And then afterwards, a few years later, you may have regretted it. But I think most of the super fans, Jason Thompson, Shannon Garrity, Julie Davis, Carl Horn, most of them had other things going on by the time they decided to leave. So, and Patrick Macias was in that too. But I don't think it was – it certainly wasn't a corporate decision by Shueisha to do it. It just sort of happened that a whole lot of fans, people who were fans at the beginning, left at the same time. But at the same time, there were a bunch of people who had come into Viz who weren't fans, who basically turned into super fans while they were there. You couldn't hang out with people like Patrick Macias and Carl Horn and Jason Thompson all in the same room without going a little bit super fanish.
Right.
Yeah, they'll transform you.
even the people who went on to make a name for themselves after they left behind a bunch of people who were, you know, pretty much as qualified as they are. So it's not, again, if there are corporate decisions made, it's not the editorial department really making them. Right. It's generally some other entity imposing it onto the editorial department. Now, Viz can't say that themselves. Basically, for when I was there too, you can't really pass the buck, because the person you'd be passing the buck on is the person licensing you the product. And if you want another license from that person ever, then you can't finger them for bad publicity. So Viz will never tell you that. Viz will say, okay, this is all our responsibility. But it's not necessarily all their responsibility, really. Somebody might be imposing a decision on them.
Yeah, it's a weird environment to work in, I think.
Yeah, it is.
So you left Viz to basically decompress, regain your wits, and you did it at a time when freelancing was a viable career.
Right.
And so during those years, you were doing most of your work for who, Delray?
At the very first, I got a bunch of jobs from Viz, and then Del Rey came in, and Del Rey started giving me more and more stuff, and more really good stuff. I mean, you don't turn down Clamp assignments. And they gave me both of their you know, big Clamp stuff, Tsubasa and Holic. So, and then after that, I got, you know, like I said, things like Mushishi and Fairy Tail and a bunch of other really high profile projects from them. And basically, they, from about 2005 all the way through 2009, summer of 2009, I was working almost exclusively for Del Rey because they were, you know, they were basically really, really good to me.
Okay. And oh, that's cool. Yeah, it was good while it lasted at Del Rey.
Yeah.
Did, what was their, what did they want from you as a translator?
They wanted a script that was accurate, that the fans could accept and could hopefully also get a wider audience. And, the biggest thing is they wanted it generally on time. So, and that's really where the translators who get into the industry and stay in the industry sort of separate themselves out. If you're, I've said this before at like conventions and stuff, but I'll repeat it. It's not mine. I got it at a comics panel from a Marvel or DC editor, in the WorldCon in 1984. LA Con in 1984, and the person said there are three things you need in the comics industry that will allow you to stay in the comics industry. This is above a certain level of competence. If you have any two of these three things, then you can stay in the comics industry. One is you can be a genius. Two, you can be on time. And three, you can be a nice guy. So if you're a genius and on time, you can be an asshole. If you're on time and a nice guy, then you can be, you know, you don't have to be a genius. And if you're a genius and a nice guy, then they'll give you a little bit of leeway on your deadlines. But so, and I make no claims to genius, so I guess I'm an okay guy and relatively on time. So that's pretty much how I was able to stay in, and it's pretty much what anybody asks. Like I said, this is above a certain level of competence. If you come in and the words don't actually mean what the words mean in Japanese, then you got problems.
Right. How would they – I mean, so a lot of people were doing freelance during those years.
Yeah.
Who at the company – so when you send the script into Del Rey, when you get your, you finish your pages, you send them into Del Rey, do they have someone checking?
They had an editor who, I think it was pretty much like Viz. At Viz, the editor, is both the script editor, which is, means you're in charge of, how people are saying things, making sure that the, characterization is on target, making sure that, you know, all sorts of storytelling devices are done the way they were in Japanese. And also the editor was proofreading, and I'm not exactly sure how it was at Del Rey because I never was in house, but I have the feeling it was pretty much the same.
And as a freelancer, if you make a mistake and that mistake makes it to print,
yeah,
do you get busted for that?
The editor gets busted.
Editor gets busted. Okay, that's what I thought.
Editor always gets busted. Then the shit rolls downhill. I mean, the editor yells at me too.
Right. Yeah.
But also, if you make too many mistakes that happen to wend their way through to see print, then you're no longer trusted, and that's the make or break thing for translation. If they don't trust you, then you don't get work.
That's interesting, and it differs from print because. If the writer makes a mistake on a feed like a feature article on an anime and I didn't catch it, mm-hmm. I can blame the writer because I can't be expected to know everything, you know?
Right.
But that's a little different from, it sounds like, translation where they
well,
can, yeah.
There, it depends. I mean, if it's just a typo, then I know that certain of my clients also hire freelance proofreaders.
Right.
And if a freelance proofreader lets go too many typos, then the proofreader is fired. But it's also, you know, it also doesn't say much for the translator that the translator lets through whole bunches of typos either. And if you get an editor who realizes it's your fault and not so much his or hers, there's pretty much gender equality in this industry. Mm. Then the editor isn't going to like you anymore. And if the editor doesn't like you anymore, you don't get assignments.
Yeah.
So it does wind up to be the same thing.
Yeah, it pretty much all works out the same way.
You've actually translated a few prose novels, right?
Only one for print. The Gundam 00, the first, very first one. And it took me so long that the publisher decided, and I quite agree, that when they went for the second one, they had to go for a different translator. It something like that really should have been translated in about a month or so, and I took about 2.5 months to do it. So that was the only prose novel that I've been hired to transfer.
Was it just the sheer amount of text, or was it just the whole having to construct grammatical arcs and things like that?
No, it was sheer amounts of text. Basically, a manga, you can probably, if you're quick, you can probably get through a tankobon of manga in a month. I'm sorry, in a week. There are some people who can do it faster. I go through a bunch of passes, so doing it in less than a week is a little bit iffy, unless it's really text light. But for prose novel, it's orders of magnitude more text. And also for Gundam 00, I had the advantage that I was able to get the anime. I was able to read the anime or watch the anime first, and then the book pretty much followed the events of the anime, adding some information, adding background characterization and stuff like that. So I had sort of a basis on what the writer himself was also working from.
So okay, so Del Rey dries up, and uh-huh. Now we're sort of in present day. So what was right. next? What did you do next?
Well, the Del Rey actually, Dallas was really nice to me. Dallas Middaugh, the the head of Del Rey, and now he also heads up production for Kodansha. But he was really nice for me. He gave me a few extra assignments to hold me over, but pretty much San Diego Comic-Con 2009 was going to every single client I could think of and going up to them and saying, "Hi, I'm Bill Flanagan. I've been in this since 1991. I've had lots of experience doing everything. Please give me work. Please, please, please." That right. sort of thing. And, you know, begging. And the begging actually turned out to work out. Bandai came in, and they were great. I've got nothing but love for Bandai. Yen Press came in and gave me a few titles. CMX gave me a title, and then it never got published. So that was too bad. But a lot of people came through and offered me work, and that pretty much saved my 2009 to the winter of 2010.
Okay. So,
but I going from but basically I went from exclusive to Bandai, exclusive to Del Rey, which has a great advantage in scheduling because you can always just talk to the one client and say, "Well, what do you need first?" And I can fit this in here, and maybe we can push off that translation a little bit there. To working for a whole bunch of people. And not being able to push off translations hardly at all, so that became something of a problem. Was learning how to schedule, and that I'm still having problems with that a little bit now. But everybody has been really, super understanding, so I'm real happy about that. I'm also doing a little bit of support work for some of the anime, and anime is drop dead deadlines. If something comes in a little late, do you like? I'm editing a few anime projects, and once it comes in, then I have to drop everything else and work on that first, and then make sure that gets out on time, and then go back to, you know, doing the manga work, which has a, you know, a longer lead time before the deadlines.
Right. So that's sort of the new reality for a freelancer is,
yeah,
you're working for whoever's left at whatever they'll pay you.
And right. And you have to get it in on whatever schedule that they say. There's a little bit of room for negotiation, but not whole heck, not as much as the freelancer would like.
I'm sort of interested to know, and you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but I am curious, how much have the rates dropped in the last, like, 4 years for someone of a translator of your value, of your stature, with your gigantic resume?
Between my top rates and my some rates I'm accepting now, it's a third of what it used to be.
Wow. Ouch.
So think about that. Think of whatever you're making right now as far as your salary, and suddenly being asked to only to live on a third of that.
I'd be living with my parents.
We basically, between summer of 2009 and winter of 2010, we basically ate through all of our savings. And fortunately, from the beginning of 2011 till now, we've had it pretty good and been able to save a little bit up, but nowhere near what we ate through. So that's been a hard pill to swallow.
What do you, and personally, what are you, aside from just the general decline, the sort of collapse of things, what do you personally attribute it to?
Well, one of the things is, and I know this for sure, is that there are people out there translating manga for free.
Right.
And you can't beat free. And I was in certain meetings, and I'm not going to say where, but certain meetings where some of the upper ups in a company were saying, these translators are translating for free. How can we get into that? Or how can we take advantage of that? Or, you know, well, it's not so much take advantage as take their translations and for free, but, you know, how can we get prices close to that is basically what was being discussed. And that's a hard thing. It's hard to compete with free. And, whether they're competent or not is a really good question, but whether they're competent or not is something that is really hard to determine by anybody who hasn't been doing translation for an awful long time, for about 4 or 5 years, well, 3 or 4 years. If you've done it for about 3 or 4 years, you may be able to determine whether somebody's actually, you know, capturing the nuance and capturing the characterization properly and stuff like that, and not making, you know, big blunders. But people who with less than that amount of experience generally are, when they're doing translations, they're guessing themselves on what it is. They're taking good educated guesses, but they don't know for certain that that is the English that goes with the Japanese. So it's so when you're guessing yourself that your own translations are accurate, it's very hard to determine that somebody else's translations are inaccurate.
So would you make the argument then that because of all these kids who have decided I'm going to translate as a hobby on the side, and bottom line CEOs or publishers or whoever who are looking at it like this golden goose, like, holy shit, I can get these kids to do this for free and don't have to pay this guy.
Right.
I mean, that's sort of a misnomer, and especially with translation, you get what you pay for.
It is true that you get with what you pay for. Whether the customer can see the quality or not is a good question.
Okay.
And wow. There's where the problem comes in. If the customer can't see the quality, then the customer isn't distinguishing on the quality. And there are some people out there, a lot of people out there in manga who can see the quality, but most likely the majority of people, majority of manga customers can't. So, and when you're reading a translation for the first time, the first translation makes the hardest impression on you.
Right.
I was just going to say, I think we've all seen the people vehemently defending outright wrong fansub translations.
But even a more interesting one was when I was working at Viz, just before Princess Mononoke came out, they did in San Francisco, they did a small film festival of Miyazaki works and other Ghibli works that were translated. Well, they weren't fan translated. They were translated professionally, but in some cases, you could tell that the quality wasn't exactly there. I saw Porco Rosso, which was brilliantly translated. I loved the way they translated Porco Rosso in the subtitles. But when I saw Omoide Poro Poro only yesterday, it was terrible. It wasn't just typos in the script. There were also sections which were meant to be poetic that were workmanlike translations that missed the entire nuance. And you could tell that there were, like, you know, five or six people in the audience. It was a packed audience of mostly sophisticated people, because these are people who look in independent theaters and look for interesting things to go see. And I was cringing all the way through it, and I looked around, and every time I cringed, I could see other people cringe, and maybe they knew Japanese, maybe they had seen a better fan sub or something like that. But, you know, those people got it. And then at the very end, when everybody was getting up, one person couldn't stand it, got up and said, "Please don't judge this film by those subtitles. The subtitles are terrible. Please, at some point, see a good subtitled version of this and you'll love it." And as I was walking out, all of these sophisticated people walking out with me said, "I didn't think the subtitles were so bad. They seemed just fine to me. I wonder what his problem was." Well, his problem was he saw a better version. He saw something that translated it more accurately. But even very sophisticated people have a problem differentiating whether the translation they see is actually the information coming through, or whether it's the information that, you know, or whether it's good enough. The movie itself was, you know, excellent and good enough to carry the subtitles. Maybe
well, the very nature of seeing a work through a subtitle is, or a translation of any sort, is that what you see is the work in your head, and
exactly.
You don't want to change that, especially if it moved you.
Right, right.
Do you think that what you're talking about, the type of translation that you're talking about, where it is, you know, it pays very close attention to the nuance, the original script, it is more of an art than a you know, building a table or something, I guess, like an IKEA shelf. Do you think that that's more appreciated or more appropriate to something like Only Yesterday, whereas the guy in his second year of translating stuff for free turns out a Naruto episode and who cares?
Well, any translation, I worked on stuff like Mad Bull 34.
That was you?
Yeah, that was me. Uncredited, fortunately. But any translation is better when you have somebody who knows what he's doing working on it.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't have to be – it will probably eventually – be that only the experienced translators only get stuff that the publishers or the distributors think is worth paying for a good translation on. But any translation is better with a better translator on it. That being said, I think most translation, even when I'm working on the really good stuff, most translation is still craft work. It's still taking sumimasen and changing it to excuse me or whatever is right for the context. It's changing aka into red. It's a craft. It's something that anybody with a certain amount of competence could do. And then when you put on top of that experience and inspiration, that's when you get a something that sort of borders on translation as art. But for the most part, it's still a craft.
Is there anything that you did early in your career that you look back on going, I could have done that better?
Oh, loads. And I'm not going to tell you what they are because no. I don't want anybody to go back and look on them and figure out where I made the mistakes.
But, at the same time, is there anything from your career overall where you think back to it and you're like, that was a really high point in my career, or the thing you were working on you were just totally in love with?
Well, I don't know if I did a really great job on it, but the first release of the Pat Labor movie was something where when you're working on it, it was another really tough translation. It was sort of it was a really dense script, and I didn't have a physical script to do it from. I had to do it listening to the audio and coming up with a translation. And I was had only been in the business for 3-4 years before that, so I probably wasn't up to it. But as I was translating it, I only got through about 5 minutes of running time per day. And considering it's over 2 hours, this took me an awful lot of time to work on. And while I was doing it, every single line that came out meant something to the story. It was a way of making the story better. And I'm going, wow, this is brilliantly written. I don't know if my translation came out as well as the original was written, but it's one of those things where you're looking at it and saying, man, I am at this point working on a work of genius. At the same time, this was like for Pat Labor 1 and Pat Labor 2. And one of the nice things was that at the time, Manga Entertainment put out both a sub and a dub, and we got to do the sub we wanted to do on it. So I did a base translation that I sent off for the dub, and that was completely rewritten. And for the subtitle that was put out by Manga Entertainment, we actually put on the subtitles ourselves and got the subtitles we wanted to put on there. So I was real proud of that one. As far as sales-wise, the thing I'm most proud of is, of course, Pokemon, because that's, I think, unit per unit, I think that's still the best-selling manga ever in the U.S.
And that's not really a surprise, but...
No, it isn't, but Naruto is beginning to approach it. I think Naruto is over a million, maybe over 2 million, but the Pokemon manga, the first 4 issues, sold a million each.
Wow. Oh my God.
Yeah. That was the one point where I was editing, I was doing base translation. Aneta Roman was doing the rewrite and I was editing it. And we put in reader response cards and we got tons back. Absolute tons, because, you know, and not that much of a percentage who read a book send in a card, but the amount of cards that came in was sort of overwhelming. It was hard to, you know, we did our best to read them, but it was even hard to read them all. It was one of those phenomenon that you know, that you are glad you experienced and don't really want to experience all that much again, because I really got a glimpse into seeing just how insane extremely popular culture is.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
That was really weird.
Bill, I was on the retail end of that one.
Oh right. That
was... I wanted to die.
I want to just mention this. You mentioned it quickly, but Pat Labor 2 must have been an unimaginable bitch to translate and feel like you're getting it right.
At least for that one, we had the script.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was a little bit better. But for the first one, I didn't have the script. It was still dense. It was still extremely dense. But and we probably missed on some of it. I'm not exactly sure. I haven't really been able to go back and look at it. And now it's not available at all. but and I'm a little afraid to go back and do it because, again, I'd only been working in the industry for about 3 or 4 years before I tackled that. But yeah, it is one where you worry if you're actually getting it right, if you're actually getting the nuance. And again, for a lot of translation, it's craftsman. It's, you know, you work as a craft. You're just, you know, hammering in the nail where it needs to be hammered. But there was a lot in those scripts that needed some inspiration in there. An interesting side note for that's kind of similar is when I'm working on Clamp projects, especially for Tsubasa and Holic. Clamp knows how they want to end it, and they drop clues all the way through, but I don't know how it's going to end. So they have to be translated extremely carefully. You have to make sure that you're not adding information that wasn't already there. Because when that line that they dropped earlier comes back later as being, okay, now you have new information and this is what that line of dialogue actually meant, that's when, you know, I'm dreading it. I'm looking at it and going, oh, God, how badly did I mangle the line originally? And why doesn't it, you know, match the situation that came up? And there are a few where I actually had to go back to Del Rey and say, okay, with the new information, I realized that the line I translated was mistranslated. And for new reprints of that old book, could you put this translation in instead of the old translation? And at the same time, I go into the notes for people who didn't buy the new reprint and do my mea culpa and say, you may notice something a little different in this line than you read previously. But sorry, my fault, my bad.
Before we get into the small handful of Twitter questions we got, I want to talk a little bit about this new concept of companies, legit publishers, trying to crowdsource translation.
Oh, right.
So you've seen this pop up, and Digital Manga is probably the most prominent organization dabbling in this sort of thing. And I really am curious, what's your take on it? Do you think it's the future? Do you hope it isn't?
I hope it isn't. At least Digital Manga is promising payment, but they're promising payment after the fact, and you don't get to choose what work you're working on. So the payment, if you're working on a project that's destined to be huge, then you get a big payoff. But if you're working on a project that's destined to sit there and not be noticed, then odds are it won't have been worth your time. So it sounds like a young person's, you know, a person who doesn't have mortgage payments or has an extra job and doesn't really need the money, but it's like extra money that'll come in and fun work. It sounds like that person's job and not something that I could really do because I've, you know, got a wife and kid and have a house and stuff like that. And I actually need to know how much money is going to be coming in, or at least the assurance that the money coming in will pay for the time that I put out on it. So that's going to be a hard one for Digital Manga. For I've heard another idea of just putting it out on the web and having people go in and translate for themselves, and then and you know the final translation will be the best because it's got a whole bunch of opinions in there, and that's got some problems too in the fact that translation is almost always opinion. Above a certain level of accuracy, it's opinion and deciding priorities. And one person's priorities is going to be different from the next. So at one point, if you do like a wiki version of translation where anybody can edit, it will never be finished. It will always be re-edited by someone who has different priorities than the first person who worked on it. So again, that's kind of weird because that's going to be it'll certainly be cheap, but the translation will change for every person who feels like they want to edit, and it won't get more accurate.
Yeah, that was sort of my next question was, do you think that even the crowdsourcing is likely to yield a trustworthy translation?
Well, no translation in the world is completely trustworthy. Everybody makes mistakes, and again, I'm not going to tell you what mistakes I make on them, on the stuff that I work on. The people with more experience make less mistakes. The people with less experience, you know, haven't encountered those situations before, and are more likely to handle them in a way that will come and bite you in the ass later. So, if there is a way to do it where a lot of very experienced people can work on it, then it will be more trustworthy than if there's it's just, you know, second year Japanese students coming in with their opinion. So that one's a hard one too. I'm not exactly sure. And also none of this has been tested. So it's really hard to make predictions on you know how it's going to flesh out. But you know, I'm personally willing to work backside on some sort of manga, but it has to be in such a way that I know that that my time will have been paid for, and That's going to be rough because, especially at the moment, in some cases with some companies' rates, my time isn't paid for to begin with. They're low enough that. It's hard to make a living just working on those rates alone. So again, the future is kind of weird. It'll probably pan out so that people with a lot of experience will get certain assignments that will allow them to, you know, make a living as a translator. But that number will be extremely few, I think. I hope I'm one of them. I might price myself out of the industry. I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, some people already have. I mean, and the other thing that sort of comes to mind is, like, with that, you do run the risk of the person who's translating it for free also has no stakes in the game. They don't really – they can just say they're bored with it and drop it, right. And then you're left holding the bag.
Right.
You know, or decide they're going to do a lazy job because they don't care that particular day or they're having a bad day or whatever. You know, when someone doesn't have any personal stake in it, they're just doing it as a hobby, you run the real risk of them losing interest, you know?
Yeah, you do. That one's another rough one. That again, one of the reasons why I mentioned the three things that where you need two of them to stay in the industry. You know, for that, the people who stay in the industry are the people who can get it in on time, get it consistently, and don't flake out. When I was an editor, one of the last things you want to do, you treat a new person very carefully because the odds that the new person will flake out are great and are very high. So you give them short series and you wait until you see what kind of results they can produce. But in this, I don't know how much time and effort, how many short series they have that they can give to these new people, because just about everybody's new.
Well, let's go ahead and get to Twitter.
Okay.
We got a handful of little quick questions for you on Twitter. All right, Chard Knight asks, have you ever had fans tell you that your translation isn't as good because they're comparing it to some random fan subber?
Oh, God, I had one translation, Video Girl Eye. At one point, there was a guy who was on all the webs who really had it in for me. He sent what happened with that was I did the original first issue was written like a lot of first episodes at the time, where the things that happen in the first episode are just to draw people in and never happen at any other time in the series. So in the first in the first installment of Video Girl Eye, the Yota is a real horn dog. I mean, he's saying, "Oh wow, this girl's got boobs," and going out going overboard for having a, you know, near naked girl in his apartment. And as anybody who's read it knows, after that he dumps that character almost immediately. But I translated it that way because that's the way it was on the page. And one of the translators one of the things a translator does is they try and stay true to what's written. And I had a couple of people in fandom. I don't know who they are, but some people in fandom really disliked me for that because it's not Yota's character. And so one guy wrote me in a long email saying, I disagree with this. And I wrote him a long email back saying, okay, but this is what's on the page and this is what I really, you know, as a translator, you sort of have to be, you know, you have to look out for that particular thing. You have to defend the words, as it were, a kind of weird way of saying it. But apparently he went back to his forum and said, I sent him an email, and his response was basically, fuck you. And when I heard about that, I go, what? Because I had written him like a page and a half email in response saying why I was doing it the way I was doing it. And then sometime during one of the Lost in Translation panels, probably around 2006, so this would have been 7 or 8 years after it had finally been published, and one person walked up and just said, I just want you to know I haven't forgiven you for Video Girl Eye, and walked away and walked out of the panel. And I'm going, whoa, that's 8 years of holding a grudge for something like that. And that's pretty amazing.
I'd say I'm shocked, but I'm not.
Yeah, yeah. I can understand it to a certain extent because you certainly with something like Video Girl Eye, it goes heavily emotional. And you know, I know this because I was heavily affected myself. But so if somebody is messing with it, with something that affected you emotionally that deeply, then I guess you can hold a grudge. Holding a grudge for 8 years is a bit excessive as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, but on the basis of it, I can see where it is. But if you ask a translator, you know, why they did something and they give you a good or at least a decent answer for them as to why, best thing to do is to just say, okay, well, at the very least, this person's a lost cause. And, you know, basically hope that, you know, if there's another translation or something like that, that it's more to your priorities. But, yeah, I've had a few people hold grudges for the way I translate things. It's not very often. Fortunately for me, again, most of the stuff that I translate, the people reading it, it's the first time they've ever read it. So I'm doing the introduction, and either that or I've paid enough attention to how fans are working on things that I can tailor my translation so that it won't make too many waves when it comes out as far as, you know, bad style waves.
In hearing that story about Video Girl Eye, it must weigh on translators a lot more than because I see this all the time, and especially in anime and manga fans. Mm-hmm. There is a tendency among so many of them to what they're emotionally, they're upset about some choice that got made. They saw something else first. That doesn't fit the character for them personally. It's not how they personally would interpret it, but they want to make it sound like it's a technical objective problem, and you have objectively made a mistake. And you are, and what they're actually saying is, I'm upset with the way you did this. I wouldn't personally have done it that way, but they want to make it sound like it's a technical thing, and you've somehow, you know, not done it according to the manual.
Well, I mean, when you're talking about it, and you say, "Well, my opinion is," then you've automatically weakened your argument.
Yeah.
So, and although it may be absolutely true that that's your opinion, you're going to want to base it on something else, something that sounds objective, and there are so many things that are not objective about translation. You have your priorities and the translator will have theirs. And if you're that invested into, if you can read Japanese and you're that invested into in a series, you'd best just stay away from all the translations because they're not going to do it the way you want it to.
Okay. DM_7 asks, what would your dream translation project be?
Well, I've already done a couple of them. I really wanted an Oshi project, and I got was able to do the two Pat Labor movies. I wanted a Otomo project, and I was able to do Harmageddon for good or ill. I've always loved Rumiko Takahashi, and I actually, you know, got a whole bunch of those. I got to do the subtitles for the Rumic World trilogy from CPM, and then I was able to do Ranma One Half subtitles and especially Maison Ikkoku subtitles. I learned Japanese almost on Maison Ikkoku. One of the things, if you're trying to learn Japanese, one of the best things to do is to get a manga, if you're interested in manga, that is to get a manga that that has most of the words that are in your textbooks. So a domestic comedy, and you know, you can build out from there. And I read Maison Ikkoku one time at the beginning before I would, as I was learning, and then reread it a bunch of times and got more and more out of it every time. So doing the subtitles for Viz's release on the anime for that was a big thing. Things I haven't done, I've never translated anything Miyazaki and would always love to do that. If I could get my hands on like Shuna no Tabi or something like that, that would be so cool. There are a bunch of one of my favorite genres is seinen love comedy, seinen romantic comedy, and there are a bunch of seinen romantic comedies in the late 80s and early 90s that I ate up in Japanese and will never and are not translated and probably will never be translated, and you know those would be things like dream projects for me. Nothing else is coming to mind right now, but I'm sure I could probably, if I sat down and thought of it, I could probably come up with a whole list of things that would qualify as a dream project. But that'll do it for right now, I guess.
Cool. Okay. All right. A long question from our favorite guy, V-Guy. he says, a lot of classic anime series are getting redubbed these days or have the potential to be redubbed. One problem with this is changing iconic lines that might have been better left the way they were. He's using, for example, in Rebuild of Evangelion, they changed Shinji's iconic line, an unfamiliar ceiling, to a ceiling which I do not recognize. The original line was actually in the title of the episode it first appeared in, and the new line felt kind of forced. He wants to know, would you change the way an English dub, if you're redubbing something or retranslating something, if there's an iconic line in it, would you change it for flow, or would you make sure to leave those iconic lines in there?
Well, as translator, the thing I want to do before I go into a translation that's into a retranslation is I don't want to read the original translation. Mm. For example, Crunchyroll is coming out with Fairy Tail, and it's gone way beyond where I've finished the last volume I translated, and I'm avoiding the English subs on that specifically because I don't want to be influenced by the previous translation. Now, it's possible that the TV series will have some brilliant lines in there that I would look at and say, oh yeah, that one I would want, that one I don't want, but it might also have some mistakes or have some lines in there that if I didn't know about them first, my mind might go in a different direction and come up with something inspired. So let me give you a quick example. I'm doing Kannagi for Bandai, and Kannagi is already out on DVD, and the series, the anime series, follows the television, or the television series follows the manga almost exactly. In a lot of cases, it's following it word for word. So, and before I started the translation on Kannagi, Bandai sent me the DVD series. So while I was doing translations, I just immediately turned off the subtitles and hearing the Japanese voice actors do it actually helps a lot, because you get you may get some nuance that you might have missed from just reading it. I mean, if there's sarcasm does not come through in text. It doesn't come through very well at all. So if there's something sarcastic in there, it's better to hear an actor say it in their sarcastic tone of voice, and then go, "Oh, okay, so that's how this is how I want to put it into English." But I turned off the subtitles all the way through until I was almost ready to send it into Bandai, to send the final into Bandai. Then I just decided to go through, turn on the subtitles. I'm past the point where I would be influenced, and watch what the subtitles did. If there were things that I thought did much better in subtitles, I might go back and reword the manga. I generally can't come out word for word because the space limitations in a manga bubble are much different than the space limitations in a subtitle at the bottom of a screen. But even there, if I felt something worked well, then I might go back and do it. So, but in general, most people don't have that kind of time. So what most translators do is they just do not read the original, go in and do translation on the new work, send it in, and then hope that nobody complains that the original was better. So I'll give odds that's what happened here. I don't know who did the original and who did the reboot, but I agree that the original ceiling line was a bit more elegant than the second line, but you know, that's what happens. It's whatever comes into your head at the time, and the best way to make the Japanese come into English. And you'll admit, I'm sure anybody would admit, that the two actually mean the same thing. They came from exactly the same source and mean the same thing. But it's, you know, but I don't think anybody was trying to be different on purpose.
Right.
You don't have to try to be different on purpose in a translation. It just comes out different. It came out different for me when I was doing it at, you know, 8 months later. It came out different enough to make it look like a completely different translation. So, and that was the same translator doing it. So you don't have to try to make it different from the original. It just is that way. And whether it's better than the original or not, well, that's for an editor to decide. And maybe an editor should have looked it over and said, "Oh, I like that translation better."
Hmm. All right. Well, Zach Logan asks, which property have you worked on that you feel is the most underrated, one you're very proud of but hasn't found an audience?
Ooh.
Mad Bull.
I think even if you mention Mad Bull, it's overrated. Heroic Legend of Arslan, I thought was really great.
Yes.
I really loved, especially the first and second volumes of that. As far as manga is concerned, I've gotten a slight advantage in that most of the stuff that I've worked on are stuff that Del Rey or whoever thought was worth hiring me as their translator for. So most of the stuff, especially since 2004, that I've been working on have been pretty high profile anyway. Because Mushishi is a seinen manga, it got a lot of talk on the on things like Twitter and stuff. But it you know, as far as I know, it didn't sell quite as well as it should have. I love doing School Rumble. Just because I love comedy, and that also apparently didn't sell as well as everybody had hoped. I'm hoping that Kodansha will come back and finish up that series.
Which is bizarre because the anime did really well.
Yeah, well, there are a bunch of things like that where the anime does extremely well and the manga just sits there. Pat Labor is a good example. When I first came into Viz had just put out the first and second volumes of Pat Labor, and they were getting sales back. And, you know, sales for the movies were doing excellent, and the television series, I guess, was doing okay for CPM. You'd know more about that than I would. No, not okay?
No.
No, not okay.
Oh, that show was a money pit.
That's too bad.
Yeah.
Because I really liked it, and I was thinking, all right, I'm coming to work for the group that makes Pet Labor, and then got hit with the reality of what sales were like for that series, and too bad. Urusei Yatsura is another one that should have done better, although, you know, early art was rough, but later art was pretty much like Ranma, so. You know, I wish that had stayed alive long enough to go into the later volumes and you know, hopefully find an audience. Odds are it might not have, but you know, that's the only Rumiko Takahashi series that really, you know, Viz tried a bunch of times. I think they tried four or five times three or four times to reboot it, and it just never sold. But I didn't work on that, so I can't really claim that as one of mine that did that. So yeah, there are a bunch. I hope people read Othello, the shoujo manga that I worked on from Del Rey. But fortunately, like Fairy Tail and Holic and Tsubasa, most of the ones I've worked on were pretty well received.
Okay, and finally from Hazukari, do you have any horror stories from working on MD Geist that you're willing to share?
MD Geist?
You can talk, well, he's out of the business now.
the interesting thing, the first thing we went to AnimeCon, I think in 91 or 90, and talked to John, and this was in San Jose, and talked to John O'Donnell and got our first assignment, which was the humanoid, and it didn't have a script, so we basically had to, you know, we were terribly green as far as animators, as far as translators were concerned, but you know, we did our best on that one. And then the very second one we got as a contract from him was another single volume contract that was MD Geist. And if I remember right, it also didn't have a script, but I could be wrong about that. We might have had a script on that. And when we got it, we looked it over and said, oh, well, we did okay on the first test. This is the second test. And as it turns out, it was one of his favorite films of all time. And, that I was kind of shocked that for the very second, you know, project you give a fledgling group that you give your favorite film of all time. One thing that happened after it was released was when we first worked on it, there was a title screen that was supposedly in English that talked about cloning technology, and we're going, oh no, that's cloning. I can tell that. And so we went ahead and did figured out a way to put in our own titles and cut out the original titles. And then for the end credits, we went and figured out a way to, you know, it wasn't so much an AMV, but it was basically taking the end titles and redoing the song and putting in the English credits. At the end, and somehow removing the Japanese credits. And we finished it off and sent it in, and he said, this is unacceptable because the original, because the contract says that we can't change any of the film. So even though the timing is the same, the words were almost exactly the same, changing cloning to cloning technology was against the contract. So we had to go back, redo it. It wasn't that much of a problem. We had pretty much done all the work anyway. But go back, redo it to professional tape, and without any of our changes. And then when it came out in the on the video market, everyone said, "Cloning technology? Geez, what kind of hack subtitlers did you get there?" So, to his credit, John came right in right afterwards and saying, no, that's not their fault. That they had to, the under contract they had to do it that way. So
that misspelling is probably the least janky thing about MD Ghost.
But it was the one that but it was the only thing that got us complaints. I mean, everything else you got MD Geist complaints, but the cloning technology thing was the one that got our company complaints.
Jeez. Okay. All right. Well, before we let you go here, what have you been working on lately? What's on shelves now that people can read that you worked on?
Okay. I unfortunately, because of a policy I've got that helps keep me employed, I have a policy that says I don't announce that I'm working on anything until either the publisher announces it or until it actually hits the shelves.
Right. Okay,
announces
yeah, no.
that I'm working on it or that until it hits the shelves. So I can't tell you any of the things that I've got coming up after this. But fortunately, Kan Nagi from Bandai just came out, and so did Bride Stories. And Bride Stories is wonderful. The art is great. Kan Nagi is not as cliched as you think it is. I suggest you go give Kan Nagi a try.
I really like the anime.
Yeah, the anime was good. The anime took all of its cues directly from the manga. The only thing that's missing in the manga pretty much is the color. Things that are coming out that I'm still working on are things like Holic, XXX Holic. Tsubasa finished its run, but some people might not have picked it up. Kobato from Yen Press, I'm working on that. And there are a bunch of other things with my name on it. And, of course, I love them all. those are the ones I guess I'd want to press. I think I'm forgetting something. Oh, I'm doing Lucky Star. But I'm probably forgetting something and going to make one of my clients terribly angry at me. But
well, that's a pretty long
I'll
list.
Weather the storm.
Okay. All right, man. Well, listen, that was great. Thank you so much for coming on and chatting with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Bill for dropping on by. Our theme song is Bucharest. The band is The New Division. You can check them out at thenewdivision.net or on iTunes. And while you're at iTunes, don't forget, leave us a little review, maybe a rating. We'd really appreciate it. Thanks for listening, and see y'all next week.